You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from today, the 26th of June. And with 1 month to go till the Olympics in Paris, we had a bit of a special. We caught up with one Emirati show jumper who's going for gold. Abdullah Al-Mari is hoping for a podium place. Meanwhile, it might be considered something of an honour to host the Olympics, but cities actually often end up in deep debt. Adam White from Front Office Sport talked us through the advantages and disadvantages of holding the Games. And the design of the Athletes' Village is coming under the spotlight. Apparently, the rooms won't have air conditioning. We heard from the Paris mayor, and we also got reaction from the American and Australian Olympic committees. Our other big topic was another sporting event, this time the F1, because events company Athara have announced another one of the artists that are going to be performing at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. It's Maroon 5. And as a consequence, we looked at how basically Athara plans for what is the biggest sporting event of the capital's calendar. We also discussed how booking agents persuade big artists to stop off in the Middle East. So yeah, we had Michael Golding from Athara and also Shiraz Hassan, who is a celebrity booker and the founder and CEO of Fame by Shiraz. Plus, our other big topic focused on how India is tackling the biggest heatwave in history. Dr. Rajiv Jayadevan, who's a former president of the Indian Medical Association, joined us on air to give us his views on how his citizens are managing to beat the heat. What is basically one of the biggest sporting events of the UAE's calendar?
Max Verstappen out of the final corner for the final time. Max Verstappen wins 19 Grand Prix in a single season.
Yeah, that is Max Verstappen, of course, winning at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, which is the final race of the season. And now we're going to look ahead to next year, because we do now know two of the four artists who are going to be performing at the Yas Alam after race concerts at that Formula One Etihad Airways Abu Dhabi GP, which takes place on December the 6th. Tell me about it, talking, I know you. Kiss me till you're drunk and I'll show you all the moves like Jagger. I've got the moves like Jagger. I've got the moves like Jagger. Yep, Maroon 5 will be headlining on Friday at the Etihad Park event. Everyone knows Maroon 5, don't they? They're led by frontman Adam Levine. They're a Los Angeles-based band. They've been topping the charts for over three decades. That's one of their most famous songs, Moves Like Jagger, but there's also Maps and Payphone. And they are going to be joining the British rock group Muse, who are set to close out the Grand Prix on December the 8th. Okay, so let's find out a bit more about how you book those artists, you know, what we've got to look forward to ultimately when it comes round to December and the Grand Prix. And joining us to tell us more is Michael Golding. He is one of the executive directors for Athara. They are the events company behind Yas Alam. Michael, lovely to have you join us on the line. How are you? How do you begin planning for this concert series? Does it start more than a year in advance?
Good to speak to you, first of all, and thank you for allowing us to come on this morning. Yeah, look, it's easily a year-long program, and a lot of conversations start quite a few years sometimes in advance of the actual booking taking place and the attendance at the Grand Prix as well. So we've had a long history of amazing acts at the Yas Alam After Race concerts, all the way back to 2009, starting with Beyoncé and Jamiroquai, and then all the way through to Aerosmith and Britney Spears and Kylie. So we look to really try and find a balance between some of those big names and then other artists who might appeal to different audiences. And that's kind of based on the journey that we go on as part of the overall event program and our audiences who are regularly coming to the Grand Prix.
Yeah, I mean, you have four nights to fill. I don't remember there being a Thursday night concert all along, but maybe that's just my memory is a bit short. What do you actually look for in the artists you book? Because there's often quite a mix.
Yeah, so the Thursday's a relatively recent introduction, because what's really important for us is that we build out value for anybody who commits to the buying the tickets early. And we want everybody to have an amazing time as well. I think this year there'll be even more to explore and make the most of, and we'll be kind of releasing more details, not just from an artist and from music side, but also from the event side as well. But the audiences really drive the artists that we look to bring across. So we have over 60% of those attending come from international markets, mostly UK and Germany. So they come over for a holiday, right? So that already brings a certain kind of demographic to who we want to appeal to. Then we have a significant domestic audience, UAE regional audience as well, where we look to try and cater for all of these different groups. So that's why the four nights is helpful, because that gives us a few different genres to kind of play with and program in. But it's not straightforward, and sometimes on the outside it looks like, oh, easy, just get hold of an artist here and there, they can come along to Abu Dhabi, it's easy. But there's a lot of different things that have to come together in terms of touring schedules, in terms of appetite to come and play around an F1, which not every artist necessarily wants to do. So there's a lot of work and a lot of effort that goes into creating what we hope is an awesome lineup for people to come and enjoy, and importantly want to come back to next year and again and again and again.
It must be quite expensive. The team on the business breakfast were basically challenging me to ask you how much it cost. And I was like, there's not a chance he's going to tell me. That's a wasted question. And they're like, no, you've got to ask, because we need to know whether or not it's an expensive process. So there we go. I'm asking, and I'm sure you're going to parry that like a professional tennis player.
So look, there are a few different things to think about in reality, right? Number one is there are kind of global market rates for talent and for artists. And they're on a sliding scale. And post-pandemic, there's been a huge surge in live entertainment. So there's a very broad spectrum of expense that people are expecting for the talent to come in, number one. Number two is, just to give a bit of a context into the Grand Prix as a whole, last year we saw all of the spend of individuals who come to the event. So that's across the tickets, the flights, the hotels, how much they spend in market. They added over 1.1 billion dirhams in economic impact. That excludes the suppliers or the people we work with on the ground here in Abu Dhabi and in the UAE as well. So the combination of the race, the weekend, the artists, all make quite a significant impact on many, many ways from an economic side, but also then from a TV, from a reputation, from a ability to activate our partners' perspective as well. So obviously I can't go into the details of exactly how much these things cost, but we battle hard and look for market rates. It's certainly not an open checkbook, and it's a good challenge that we have to go through year on year.
I mean, you get a sense there of just how important this F1 is for the Abu Dhabi tourist economy, and also, like you say, for its reputation globally. What's so interesting about the F1 is that it feels like the audience for these races is changing, in part because of that Netflix show. What's it called? Born to Drive.
Drive to Survive.
Yeah, I mean, even I've watched it. And I'm not a massive fan of cars going round and round, I have to admit. But once you get into the psychology of the drivers and the politics, then all of a sudden I'm all over it. Like, I'm like, oh, I know who he is. Like, I can't see his face at the moment, but I know everything that's been going on within the team. And has that meant that you've got more women, for example, coming?
Absolutely. Drive to Survive is an amazing part of the evolution of the sport, bringing in new audiences, attendees, and viewership has meant that ladies' interest in the sport has kind of gone through the roof. Over 30% now of attendees, 35% of attendees, and those who are interested in Formula One as a whole are ladies. We have F1 Academy now as a mainstay to the sporting agenda, the F1 sporting agenda. So that's ladies racing competitively as part of the race weekends, which you may have seen in Barcelona this weekend. We've got two Emirati sisters, the Kabasi sisters, who are racing for RB and for Red Bull as well. So There's some amazing stories coming out of that. And that in turn is a great example of more female interest in the sport, more females attending, which in turn then allows us to build out the female sport across the globe. We have up to about 50% of new attendees coming in who aren't necessarily F1 fans. They're there for a combination of the entertainment and the race action. And to your point, it's the drama off track as much as it is about the on-track action. It's funny listening to Chris yesterday when they announced Maroon 5.
Yes.
On your partner radio. And a lot of the conversation was about which driver everybody fancied and who is going to marry who and all of that good stuff.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it's about, right? Is beyond just that on track action, which is so enticing and so interesting. It's magical. It's a truly kind of magical sport. And yeah. It's amazing to be part of it. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, yes, you announced yesterday about Maroon 5. We already knew that we had Muse. What are you now looking for in your next two additional artists? Do you have, you know, something of a checklist of what you want for? I mean, Maroon 5 is pop, aren't they? But maybe a DJ. Yeah. I'm sort of trying to think what you might go for next.
Look, that spread is important to your point. So we've got something a little bit rocky on the Sunday, got something a little bit more poppy and mainstream perhaps on the Friday. So kind of there are a few different genre gaps that we're looking to try and fill, and hopefully we'll be able to announce over the next course of the next few weeks. And we have some additions from a sporting perspective in the race week as a whole, as well as we try to build out beyond just the race weekend. So there's plenty more news to follow on the Yas Salaam after his concert side, as well as then kind of other components of the race weekend. It's very much a complete package. And look, I promise you, tickets are selling fast, and I'm partly here to make sure that kind of everyone sees that they should kind of get involved now if they can. They have a chance for the next 6 days to get a 20% discount on Golden Circle upgrades for those concerts. So the earlier you become part of the event, and it is becoming part of the event, then I really urge everyone to come and come down to Abu Dhabi in December.
Fantastic. So tickets still available. Michael Golding there. Thank you very much indeed for giving us the lowdown on what is clearly a very important event, not just for Abu Dhabi, but of course for the UAE as a whole. Michael Golding is one of the executive directors for Ethara. They are the event company behind Yas Salaam, which is the sort of the concerts that they have around the F1. Thank you very much indeed. We now know two of the top chart artists who will be entertaining racegoers at this year's Formula One in Abu Dhabi. Maroon 5 have been confirmed for the Yas Salaam after race concerts. They're going to be performing on Friday. These guys are going to headline on Saturday the 8th. So that, of course, is the British rock group Muse. And, of course, the Grand Prix, one of the biggest sporting events in the UAE's calendar. We've just heard how big an impact it has on tourism revenues for the Emirates. Not least because, of course, it puts the UAE on the global map. The F1 gets a global audience on TV of at least 1.5 billion a year. So it's really important for Abu Dhabi to book those quality artists for the aftermatch events. So, is it easy? Let's find out. Shiraz Hassan, who is the founder and CEO of Fame by Shiraz, has joined me on the radio. Now, Shiraz deals with celebs all the time, sometimes grumpy celebs, sometimes difficult celebs, sometimes totally charming celebs. Shiraz, it's lovely to have you in. How are you?
I'm back.
Oh, it's so good to have you in. Tell me, is the Abu Dhabi an appealing place for artists to perform? You know, do they get excited about being present at the Grand Prix, for example?
Yeah, 100%. So I deal with a lot of agents, managers on a consistent basis, right? So I have the Fame Studios in the heart of the Sunset Strip that promotes Abu Dhabi, that promotes Dubai. The only company that actually says, if you're an artist, if you're a celeb, and you want to come to the Middle East, specifically Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Saudi, contact us. So I get a lot of inquiries, and Abu Dhabi, they do big.
Yeah.
Right. You know, when you're talking F1, there's two sides of it. The artist wants to come.
Because it's fun.
Because it's huge.
Yeah.
It gives them fame. The manager wants money.
Okay.
So there's the challenge, right? So the celeb is always, I want to do it. You know, like J-Lo, example. I took J-Lo to Qatar, did big activations with her. She wants to do it. Manager, how do I get the maximum money?
Okay.
So it does come down, obviously, because they're surrounded by managers and agents who are all trying to get their commissions and so forth. But for a career or to keep someone relevant, performing at F1, I mean, you know, you've had Beyonce, you've had Eminem, you've had Rihanna. I mean, you've had Prince. I mean, you've had big names that have come here. These are not small artists. These are massive artists, right? So if you're an upcoming artist, or even if you're a big artist, you want to get in. The okay. challenge comes for the people who are bringing the stars. It's a numbers game.
Yeah, and what numbers are they getting?
In millions. I mean, you're talking millions. And sometimes even back end, right? So they'll say, okay, I'll charge X. Some stars like J-Lo, for the love of, oh, I don't know what to say, that her demands drove me nuts.
What, I mean, so everything, she wants percentage? So
besides that, you know, I'm giving you the, you know, come on, first class, Emirates, Etihad, Qatar, they're the best islands in the world, airlines in the world, right? Oh no, I have to have this specific private jet. I have to have this. I have to have this. I have to have this. Then you get the money, you're paying them the fee of millions, and then it's the plus plus. So if you're paying 2-3 million, then the plus plus is another 2 million. You're in at 5 million, right? So the person who's bringing them over, it's generally the artist is very hungry. Abu Dhabi has done a fantastic job. F1 is a magnet. It's a magnet for artists. The challenge becomes when people get greedy.
Okay.
That's the challenge.
Why are people getting greedy?
Because first of all, you have to remember an agent or a manager pays his bills on something called 10 or 20%.
Okay.
So they don't get paid. They're not on salary, right? You know, you eat what you kill in our business. Okay. So you got to go out there and you got to get it. And when you get it, then you're going to get paid. So you're going to try and get the maximum amount. The challenge right now that's happening is in my business, I know for consistently, I keep getting thrown the word Saudi Arabia. Aww. So, you know, when Saudi Arabia is not, you know, they're bringing celebrities not to make money.
They're not playing by the game. They don't need to make a profit, do they?
Everybody else is going, I'm going to spend X and I'm going to make Y.
Yeah.
That's traditional business in celebrity. Saudi came and said, I'm just going to pay you whatever you want, plus, 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 but I don't want to make money. And even if I don't get the crowd there, I'll give out the tickets for free. Let's pack out this place. I want to make a statement. So the challenge to that has been in Hollywood specifically that I see on a weekly basis, I get this. Well, why would I get paid this when I can get this?
Wow, that
and
is interesting.
A lot of the times, you have to remember that not many people know in the business of Hollywood, the star never gets to know about the opportunity until a deposit has been paid. Just so you know, always remember that. That's the game of fame. So if I want to book you, you're a big star, I have to first put money in an escrow account, big money, not small. Could be like for J-Lo, I put in, if I'm not mistaken, it was 1 million in an escrow account before we could even play. Just before to show that my client has money, they're ready, let's go.
Now, we're going to turn our attention now to an international news story because India is buckling under a profound heat wave and it's proving deadly. The north has already endured what is being described as a scorching summer. One part of Delhi reached 49.9 degrees Celsius in late May, and that is the capital's highest temperature on record. Now, heat waves are common in India, specifically in May and June, but the problem is that the heat is persisting now even after the sun has set. The night is staying hot, and that is causing serious problems. A report by the Center for Science and Environment tackling urban heat stress in Delhi found that the city is cooling by only 8.5 degrees Celsius at night, compared to 12 degrees colder in the suburbs. Let's discuss the impact of those temperatures. I'm joined now by Dr. Rajiv Jayadevan. Now, he is former president of the Indian Medical Association. Joins me now on the line. Thank you so much for your time, sir. Are you seeing a lot of cases of heat stroke in India at the moment?
That depends where you live in India. As you said, the heat wave has been particularly severe this year, and the states in the northwestern region of the country have seen a toll directly and indirectly resulting from the heat wave. Now, when I say directly, we are talking about things like heat stroke, dehydration. Indirect causes of death can occur, which means that people who are already living in poor health, knowingly or otherwise, could be pushed over the edge by these conditions. And we call it the result of a cumulative physiological stress on the human body, because the body is expected to work efficiently at certain temperatures, and when it's unable to do so, the internal systems could fail. Yes, more heat wave problems are occurring.
Are you actually losing people? Are people dying from this heat?
Indeed, they are. There are reports of heat stroke. If you look at reports from the Delhi hospitals that you mentioned, people are being brought in an unconscious state, sometimes found after an overnight sleep. They may be found unconscious. There are reports of that. People who collapse at work, people who collapse during a day's work. For instance, if you have to cycle a few kilometers for work and back and come back home, yes, there are instances of individuals collapsing. But I must add that not all of these could be heat related. But when that occurs in someone who's in a vulnerable condition, yes, it is called a heat related outcome. And if prompt medical attention is not given, a heat related event, such as a heat stroke, is what is called a time-related condition, which means it is time-sensitive, just like a heart attack or a stroke. If you don't initiate the measures, the treatment measures early, we might lose the patient.
What is the reality of the impact of this nighttime heat, the fact that it's not cooling down and people's bodies, therefore, aren't cooling down?
I'm glad you mentioned that. There's something called the urban heat island effect, which is particularly worse in urban areas, which are built up. There are plenty of pavements. There's a lot of concrete, which means that the nighttime conditions where you're expected to find some relief from the heat do not do so. And the night remains warm. And people in particular who live in marginalized neighborhoods, say, for example, makeshift homes that might have corrugated metals for a roof, which is not insulated, with inadequate ventilation, for instance, in crowded neighborhoods, yes, they are most vulnerable. That is particularly so after the onslaught of the so-called greenhouse gases, which aggravates the greenhouse effect. In plain English, it basically means that the heat from the earth is reflected backwards onto the earth, worsening the condition.
What are you advising to citizens of these hot cities? What can they do? I mean, if they don't have access to air conditioning, they might not have access even to electricity, so you can't even get fans. What can people do to try and reduce their temperatures?
Yes, it is it requires a multi-level intervention. I would say the first and perhaps the most effective would be mass education. We need an awareness building. See, heat or climate, unlike overt things like fire, flood, or lightning, are not perceived as a health risk by most people. That has to change. Heat is a risk factor, and there are reports of excess deaths from across the world, including from India. Now, the public needs to understand that they have to take extra measures during a heat wave. For instance, reduce your exposure time to overt heat if you can. The employers have to comply, and that has to be monitored. People have to stay hydrated. You don't wait until you're thirsty to drink water. You must not only drink water, but also electrolytes. Simple things like the fan that you mentioned, which is quite economical. You could use an umbrella, proper clothing, and proper ventilation, even if the place is not air-conditioned. Sometimes if you ensure good ventilation, that itself can be good enough. But I must emphasize that in any community, there are individuals who are frail, sometimes bedridden, who have dementia, and then there are children, and there are other vulnerable groups. They require special attention. Yes, they need to be cared for in a specific way that addresses the ill effects of heat on their health.
Dr. Rajiv Jayadevan, thank you so much for your time this morning. Really interesting to get you on the agenda. Thank you very much indeed. Former president of the Indian Medical Association there with some fantastic advice on what people can do to avoid getting heat stroke ultimately, even in India, where there have been serious cases of up to 40,000 cases of heat stroke reported there since March. That's according to the Ministry of Health there, and at least 110 people have died. We will be following that story, as well as all the sort of heat based stories around the world over this summer. But yes, thank you very much indeed there to Dr. Rajiv Jayadevan. Right, there is just 1 month to go until this. Yeah, so that's the fanfare for the Olympics. I have to say, I'm not familiar with it. It sounds almost sort of English, doesn't it? It sounds like the royal family could be coming past. But this year's Paris 2024 Olympics is due. Only a month to go. It's going to showcase nearly 4,000 hours of live support. There are 329 gold medals to be awarded, 32 sports, 18 days of competitions, and they're going to be taking place across Paris and in other parts of France as well. Now, the opening ceremony is on the 26th of July. Intriguingly, it's going to take place along the River Seine instead of in a stadium, which is quite different. I don't think any other cities have done that before. And competing this year will be several Emiratis looking to put the UAE on the podium, looking in many ways to put the UAE on the Olympic map, because so far the Emirates have only ever won two medals. Now, this is one of them.
Gold medal and Olympic champion. Establishing a new Olympic record and representing the United Arab Emirates, Ahmed Al Maktoum.
Yeah, that's the gold that was won at the 2004 Athens in shooting, specifically in the double trap. And it was won by Sheikh Ahmed Al Maktoum, who still is the UAE's greatest Olympian. We've also won a bronze back in 2016 in Rio de Janeiro. That was in judo, and that was won by Sergio Toma. So what are our chances this year? Well, the UAE is sending 22-year-old Safia Al-Saya to compete in the cycling. That's in the women's road race. We've got five men and one woman competing in judo. And there's also a show jumping team going. That's four people. One of our biggest medal hopes is probably the Emirati show jumper, Abdullah Al-Mari. He's 40 years old. He's going to compete in both individual and team events. He's got three teammates, Ghanem Al-Hajiri, Abdullah Al-Maheri and Omar Al-Mazouki, who actually was the first Emirati to win a silver medal at a Youth Olympics in Buenos Aires back in 2018. So we've got some pretty good medal hopes this year. And certainly here on the agenda, we are going to be following the Emirati journey through the Olympics very, very closely indeed. Kicking us off, I managed to catch up with Abdullah Al-Mari a little earlier. That was sort of in between his very busy schedule of training in the United Kingdom. I started by asking him how long he's been preparing for this event.
It's a cycle, as everyone knows, for the games. It happens every 4 years, and the qualification starts 2 years prior to the date of the games itself. And we had a qualification event in February of last year, and that was the beginning of, I would say, the cycle of qualification. And we went to Qatar against the north of Africa and Middle East countries. So Egypt, Morocco, Qatar, Saudi, UAE. And these are the countries that managed to have a team at that level, because eventually it's going to be the highest level of the sport for the Olympic Games. That's why there's not that many teams who went to the qualifier. But we knew the standard. The five that did go were actually the best in the region. And we battled it out in Qatar, and Saudi actually won the qualifier and we came second. And there were two spots for the qualification. And we failed to qualify in 2019 for Tokyo. That was quite heartbreaking. Egypt and Morocco ended up qualifying over there. So we were actually happy that us and Saudi actually managed to qualify. So we knew we were going against the countries that qualified prior, and we knew the challenge won't be easy.
You get a sense there of just how important the Olympics is to you. Do you see it along with your team members as the pinnacle of show jumping?
That's exactly the right word. It's the pinnacle of show jumping. We know that for sure. All the idols, all the role models we watched throughout the years, I've been riding for more than 20 years now, always celebrate their careers by how many Olympics they did, how many medals they won at the game. And we knew that's something we need to put the UAE on the map by competing at that level. And for me personally, to be, you know, able to go there and represent my country, I know it would boost my career and my CV in the sport in a huge way.
Are you going to be competing as an individual, or is this purely a team event?
It's a combination of both. It starts with the team event, then we have 2 days off, and then all the horses and combinations go to something called a vet check, which makes the horses eligible to compete again. And then around 70 combinations can go in and compete individually on the individual medal.
Okay, so this might sound a bit of a strange question, but what do you actually do in the competition?
In the beginning, you have a combination of 12 jumps, and usually these 12 jumps would have a couple of combinations. rounds. So in total, around 15 efforts. Each round will have around 15 efforts. Let's say for the team competition, round number one, each team will go and jump these obstacles. And according to the scores of all the 20 countries, they'll have the best 10. And that's round number two. So the other 10 teams will qualify. The same process, they'll all go back to zero. The same process will happen again. And the best three teams will compete against each other. In case there was equality, let's say three or four teams end up on zero in round number two, they'll have an extra round, less obstacles, usually 8 jumps, and the fastest team would win the medal. So that's the team competition, and the same process will happen with the individuals.
And you all have your own horse for this event, and do you only ride one horse?
Yes, when the qualification happens, you have to get something called an MER, minimum eligibility requirement, for you and your horse. So it has to be a horse that you know that you competed at a certain level with, that is eligible to go to the games, and then you only have that horse to compete with. So I qualified with two horses. By the time the final entries for the games will happen, which is first week of July, then we have to decide with the chef d'équipe, William Funnel, our team trainer. He would say this horse is fitter for the games, and we'll go forward with it. We'll have nearly 3 weeks till then, and hopefully that horse would be the one, the right choice eventually to beat in the best way possible.
And what are the two horses' names?
My main horse would be BBS McGregor, and the second one is James. He has a Belgian name, so James Van de Oude Heijhoff. We call him James. It's much easier, but they're both owned by Shara' Stables, which is owned by Sheikha Fatma bint Hazza' Al Nahyan, and she's been honestly the main source of improving the sport, and I would say in the UAE for the last few years. She has a huge breeding program, huge sponsorship when it comes to big events, which helped us compete in a lot of the big shows in Europe this summer. And throughout that, I think it's her vision of having locals competing at the highest level. And like I said, she achieved one of the biggest milestones in our equestrian career, where the country never qualified as a team. And with her guidance and vision, we end up qualifying, and hopefully we do her proud in the games itself.
And so how much training do you have to do to be of an Olympic standard? Is it literally your whole life?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're lucky enough to have a couple of riders who are on the team in their 20s at the moment. But for myself, it took me more than 20 years to get to where I am right now. And I've trained with a lot of Olympians, world champions, great, I would say, trainers to get to this level. Been through a few championships myself, Asian Games, World Cup Finals. It's my first Olympics, obviously, but you know, it's tough. And all honesty, I'm 40 now, and in equestrian terms, that's actually quite young. I know for other athletes, by the time they're 40, they're already retiring. But in our sport, I'm considered young, which is a good thing. So you can still get a bit of mileage and hopefully go for at least a decade or more in the sport.
So how many hours do you train a day with your horses?
A horse would train not more than an hour, in all honesty, but we have a group of horses that work around us. So we're the athletes, but they're also considered as athletes themselves. And I have 4 to 5 horses. So training will go for at least 4 or 5 hours a day. We also train ourselves as athletes to strengthen our muscles, etc. That's a different system also all by itself. But to get to that level, like I said, you need a lot of experience. Training should not stop at all. Whenever you take a break, other athletes are doing a little bit more, and that's the edge you try to beat them with.
And what do you think will be running through your mind as you head for Paris for this extraordinary Games?
Good question. A dream for everyone to compete in any Olympic Games, and then we know how hard it is. I personally would love to live the moment as much as possible. I've been to a few championships, not as big as the Games itself, but I've been to the Asian Games. We've recently been to the Asian Games in Hangzhou in China, and we try to live the moments, have as much memories as possible. And then when the serious part comes, try to be as competitive as we can. We know the challenge will be quite tough. All these countries that we were competing against are way ahead of us, I would say, experience, ability, etc. We're new at this stage. We know we're a small country, but I think the Olympics is also made of these kind of stories, you know, small countries doing something extraordinary, and we truly believe it.
That is Abdullah Al-Mari, who is the Emirati show jumper, going for gold at the Paris Olympics, which is due to start in about a month's time. We will be tracking all of the UAE athletes on their journey to Paris. And of course, once they're there, their successes. So we will be keeping a very close eye on that right here on The Agenda. There's just a month to go until the Paris 2024 Olympics. Here on The Agenda, we are very closely anticipating the Games, and we're certainly going to be following the stories of all our Emirati athletes over the next few weeks. The event itself sees 329 medals awarded in 32 sports over 18 days of competition. My goodness me. Obviously in Paris, but also in other parts of France. And we're going to have the opening ceremony on the 26th of July. It's going to take place along the River Seine. That is instead of in a stadium, which is where they traditionally take place. And actually, this year's Olympics is different in quite a lot of ways. 95% of the infrastructure was apparently either existing or temporary, so as to keep costs low. And the event will also run 100% on renewable energy. It is still going to cost 8 billion euros, though. You basically, if you want your euros, you sort of times it by five to get you to dirhams. So, oh my goodness, my maths is so bad. 400 billion, 40 billion dirhams, something like that. It's a big number, isn't it? And while hosting the Olympics might be sort of seen as a real honour, and certainly some cities do see it that way, the reality is that almost every Olympic host ends up in serious debt after the Games. Now, I remember the Games in London. There were lots of protests. People were furious about it taking place. I think net, I think London considers itself a winner as a consequence. I think it was the 2008 Games. But because there are advantages as well. Let's find out a bit more about them. We'll talk about the disadvantages too. I'm joined now by Adam White. He's founder and CEO of Front Office Sports. Now, they're a media brand who cover the business of sports. Lovely to have you join us in the studio. Adam, how are you?
I'm great. First time in the region. Really excited to be here and excited to chat a little bit about the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, how is Paris preparing? We heard a bit about it there, but I know that there are protests as well in the city, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I feel like this is a kind of ongoing happenings with the Olympics, right? There's going to be a group of people who are not excited about it. I think the one thing that France did well is that they said, hey, look, our cost overrun is only going to be $3 billion. The rest of it has to be covered by private investment. So whether that's sponsorship, ticket sales, et cetera. So I think what you mentioned earlier at the top of the show, with 95% of the infrastructure already being in place, I think that's actually like a huge advantage because of the fact that it's going to keep costs low. I was doing a little bit of research this morning, and it felt like, based off of what I was seeing, that the Paris Olympics should be probably the least of cost, least costly in the past 20 years or so when you think about that. So that's, I think, comes down to the infrastructure side of things. That also comes down to the fact that Paris is a major metropolitan area. They already have the international airports, the lodging to handle all of these things. And so if I had to guess, I feel like the future of the Olympics is going to be in more major developed cities because of the fact that you're seeing just a lot of unrest from other areas in which you're trying to build all of these things, and then they go unused. Right, I think I saw something too today that all of the athlete village in Paris for the Olympics is going to be turned into low-income housing, which is a great outcome.
Yeah, I mean, we saw in London, for example, that the athletes' village there became a whole new neighbourhood. Yeah. I mean, a really beautiful neighbourhood. It rehabilitated the east of London, and things have really changed in the city as a consequence. But I remember going to Barcelona a few years after the Olympics there, and the entire village, all the facilities, just, I mean, we did a bus tour around it, but we were the only people there. It's extraordinary how often you get total white elephants as a consequence
Of
the Games.
I think you're starting to see more of the countries try and be smarter with that, but you see it often places where they'll build up all of this, they'll spend, and that's where I think a lot of the protests come from, is the fact that, hey, you've spent a lot of the government money, you've spent a lot of the taxpayers' money on building something that's used for a month and then not used at all ever again. And I think you're trying to see 100% sustainability from the Paris, right? Like, they're doing some of these things to kind of say, hey, look, yeah, we're spending money, but we're also doing and investing in the future of the city and the future of the country. I believe I saw something that they expect anywhere between 2.5 to 3 million visitors over the course of the month for the Olympics, right? With tickets and everything like that. That's a meaningful impact. And I think it's something around $6 to $11 billion in economic impact. They're forecasting between 2018 and 2034, which they kind of consider the Olympic cycle, right? The 6 years leading into the Olympics and then the 10 years after that. And so it'll be interesting to see what comes out of it. But again, as you look forward to the 2028 Olympics in LA, similar setup where most of the infrastructure is already in place. I believe they're forecasting that that's going to cost around $8 billion. Again, I think that's around where the things will set out. But again, all of the infrastructure is in place in a major metropolitan city, an area that can handle all of the influx of travelers and tourism and things like that. So it will be interesting to see after that where the cities that host, and we're starting to see joint bids too. I think that's another way to kind of limit costs, is you'll start to see joint bids on major programs. So it's instead of it just being all on one country, it'll be spread through a variety of different countries.
Interestingly, LA is the only city that's managed to make a profit out of the Olympics in the past. I did a bit of reading this morning as well to sort of figure that out. And I suppose there is a soft power that it might be harder to quantify in hosting an Olympics. You know, it means that for the next month at least, or 2 months, Paris is going to be on everyone's lips.
Everyone's lips, everyone's screens. I mean, millions, if not billions, of people will be tuning in across the globe, right? So you see all this, right? Like, this is the reason why sports has become a massive driver of, I would say, economic investment from a tourism authority, from a boards. You see it across the globe because of the fact that you have massive scale, you have captive audiences, and you have alignments with major brands, whether it's on the team side of things or on the athlete side of things. And of course, it's an opportunity for national pride, right? Yeah. Like, obviously for the people who live in France, but then also for the people who live in other regions that are watching their athletes compete in the Olympic Games. And so, I mean, look, it's a month-long commercial for the country for the most part, right? So you should be able to take advantage of it, and hopefully that the economic impact will be positive coming out of that.
We've definitely spotted that here in the UAE and in the wider Middle East, the impact of sport on a country's profile. Are we seeing more of that from your experience?
Yeah, I think 100%. I think it really just depends on the level of sporting infrastructure in the countries, right? Like in the U.S., it's probably a little bit different because of the fact that for them, you know, most of the infrastructure is already in place. The profile of the region is higher, right? But if you're trying to attract a group of people or people who are coming for an event, sporting examples is a great way to do that. I mean, look, if you look at it at a more micro level in the States, Las Vegas was always known as a major city and everything like that. But then all of a sudden you brought in multiple sports teams. You have a hockey team, an NFL team. They had the Super Bowl there. Las Vegas has become like the center of sporting ecosystem in the States all of a sudden, right? And that's because of the fact that you brought these major sporting events, Formula One there as well. Obviously, there's a bunch of Formula One races out here in the region as well. And so I think it really just depends on where the various countries are at in their kind of life cycles and their economic life cycles, where you're seeing big tourism boards leaning in to sports because of the fact that they know there's captive audiences there and people who are interested and probably willing to travel to other places.
Such an interesting conversation. Certainly earlier in the program, we were talking about the impact of the Abu Dhabi F1 on the capital. So there's a bit of a theme on the agenda today. But Adam, thank you for your time. Thanks for coming into the studio. Now, if you've got any comments on any of those stories, please do find us on social media. You can either go to Dubai Eye 103.8 FM or you can find me. I'm at Georgia.Tolly on most social platforms. And make sure you subscribe so you don't miss a single episode.